ages are so vividly reflected. It is a vision of a universal empire, which is supposed to be the natural and necessary government of the world, having a divine authority distinct from the papacy, yet coextensive with it. It is not the ghost of the dead Roman Empire sitting crowned upon the grave thereof, but the legitimate heir and successor of it, justified by the ancient virtues of the Romans and the beneficence of their rule. Their right to be the governors of the world is also confirmed by the testimony of miracles, and acknowledged by St. Paul when he appealed to Caesar, and even more emphatically by Christ himself, who could not have made atonement for the sins of men if he had not been condemned by a divinely authorized tribunal. The necessity for the establishment of a universal empire is proved partly by a priori arguments such as the unity of God and the unity of the family or nation, partly by perversions of scripture and history, by false analogies of nature, by misapplied quotations from the classics, and by odd scraps and commonplaces of logic, showing a familiar but by no means exact knowledge of Aristotle. Of Plato there is none. But a more convincing argument still is the miserable state of the world, which he touchingly describes. He sees no hope of happiness or peace for mankind until all nations of the earth are comprehended in a single empire. The whole treatise shows how deeply the idea of the Roman Empire was fixed in the minds of his contemporaries. Not much argument was needed to maintain the truth of a theory to which his own contemporaries seemed so natural and congenial. He speaks, or rather preaches, from the point of view not of the ecclesiastic, but of the layman, although as a good Catholic, he is willing to acknowledge that in certain respects the empire must submit to the church. The beginning and end of all his noble reflections and of his arguments, good and bad, is the aspiration that in this little plot of earth belonging to mortal man, life may pass in freedom and peace. So inextricably is his vision of the future bound up with the beliefs and circumstances of his own age. The Utopia of Sir Thomas More is a surprising monument of his genius, and shows a reach of thought far beyond his contemporaries. The book was written by him at the age of about 34 or 35, and is full of the generous sentiments of youth. He brings the light of Plato to bear upon the miserable state of his own country. Living not long after the Wars of the Roses, and in the dregs of the Catholic Church in England, he is indignant at the corruption of the clergy, at the luxury of the nobility and gentry, at the sufferings of the poor, at the calamities caused by war. To the eye of More, the whole world was in dissolution and decay. And side by side with the misery and oppression which he has described in the first book of the Utopia, he places in the second book the ideal state which, by the help of Plato, he had constructed. The times were full of stir and intellectual interest. The distant murmur of the Reformation was beginning to be heard. To minds like More's, Greek literature was a revelation. There had arisen an art of interpretation, and the New Testament was beginning to be understood as it had never been before, and has not often been since, in its natural sense. The life there depicted appeared to him wholly unlike that of Christian commonwealths, in which he saw nothing but a certain conspiracy of rich men procuring their own commodities under the name and title of the commonwealth. He thought that Christ, like Plato, instituted all things common, for which reason, he tells us, the citizens of Utopia were the more willing to receive his doctrines. Howbeit, I think this was no small help in furtherance in the matter, that they heard us say that Christ instituted among his all things common, and that the same community doth yet remain in the rightest Christian communities. Utopia. The community of property is a fixed idea with him, though he is aware of the arguments which may be urged on the other side. These things, I say, when I consider with myself, I hold well with Plato, and do nothing marvel that he would make no laws for them that refuse those laws, whereby all men should have and enjoy equal portions of riches and commodities. For the wise men did easily foresee this to be the one and only way to the wealth of a community, if equality of all things should be brought in and established. Utopia. We wonder how in the reign of Henry VIII, though veiled in another language and published in a foreign country, such speculations could have been endured. He is gifted with far greater dramatic invention than anyone who succeeded him, with the exception of Swift. In the art of feigning, he is a worthy disciple of Plato. Like him, starting from a small portion of fact, he founds his tale with admirable skill on a few lines in the Latin narrative of the voyages of Amerigo Vespucci. He is very precise about dates and facts, and has the power of making us believe that the narrator of the tale must have been an eyewitness. We are fairly puzzled by his manner of mixing up real and imaginary persons. His boy John Clement, and Peter Giles, citizen of Antwerp, with whom he disputes about the precise words which are supposed to have been used by the imaginary Portuguese traveler Raphael Hiflode. "I have the more cause," says Hiflode, "to fear that my words shall not be believed, for that I know how difficultly and hardly I myself would have believed another man telling the same, if I had not myself seen it with mine own eyes." Or again, "If you had been with me in Utopia, and had presently seen their fashions and laws as I did, which lived there 5 years and more, and would never have come thence but only to make the new land known here," etc. Moore greatly regrets that he forgot to ask Hiflode in what part of the world Utopia is situated. He would have spent no small sum of money rather than it should have escaped him. Then he begs Peter Giles to see Hiflode or write to him and obtain an answer to the question. After this, we are not surprised to hear that a professor of divinity, perhaps a late famous vicar of Croydon in Surrey, as the translator thinks, is desirous of being sent thither as a missionary by the High Bishop. Yea, and that he may himself be made Bishop of Utopia, nothing doubting that he must obtain this bishopric with suit. And he counteth that a godly suit which proceedeth not of the desire of honor or lucre, but only of a godly zeal. The design may have failed through the disappearance of Hiflode, concerning whom we have very uncertain news after his departure. There is no doubt, however, that he had told Moore and Giles the exact situation of the island, but unfortunately at the same moment Moore's attention, as he is reminded in a letter from Giles, was drawn off by a servant, and one of the company from a cold caught on shipboard coughed so loud as to prevent Giles from hearing, and the secret has perished with him. To this day, the place of Utopia remains unknown. The words of Phaedrus, "O Socrates, you can easily invent Egyptians or anything," are recalled to our mind as we read this lifelike fiction. Yet the greater merit of the work is not the admirable art, but the originality of thought. Moore is as free as Plato from the prejudices of his age, and far more tolerant. The Utopians do not allow him, who believes not in the immortality of the soul, to share in the administration of the state, laws. Howbeit they put him to no punishment, because they be persuaded that it is in no man's power to believe what he list, and no man is to be blamed for reasoning in support of his own religion. One of our company in my presence was sharply punished. He, as soon as he was baptized, began, against our wills, with more earnest affection than wisdom, to reason of Christ's religion, and began to wax so hot in his matter, that he did not only prefer our religion before all other, but also did despise and condemn all other, calling them profane and the followers of them wicked and devilish, and the children of everlasting damnation. When he had thus long reasoned the matter, they laid hold on him, accused him, and condemned him into exile, not as a despiser of religion, but as a seditious person and a raiser-up of dissension among the people. In the public services, no prayers be used, but such as every man may boldly pronounce without giving offense to any sect. He says significantly, "There be that give worship to a man that was once of excellent virtue or of famous glory, not only as God, but also the chiefest and highest God. But the most and the wisest part, rejecting all these, believe that there is a certain godly power unknown, far above the capacity and reach of man's wit, dispersed throughout all the world, not in bigness, but in virtue and power. Him they call the Father of all. To him alone they attribute the beginnings, the increasings, the proceedings, the changes, and the ends of all things. Neither give they any divine honors to any other than him." so far was more from sharing the popular beliefs of his time. Yet at the end, he reminds us that he does not in all respects agree with the customs and opinions of the utopians which he describes, and we should let him have the benefit of this saving clause, and not rudely withdraw the veil behind which he has been pleased to conceal himself. Nor is he less in advance of popular opinion in his political and moral speculations. He would like to bring military glory into contempt. He would set all sorts of idle people to profitable occupation, including in the same class priests, women, noblemen, gentlemen, and sturdy and valiant beggars, that the labor of all may be reduced to 6 hours a day. His dislike of capital punishment and plans for the reformation of offenders, his detestation of priests and lawyers. Compare his satirical observation. They, the utopians, have priests of exceeding holiness, and therefore very few. His remark that, although every one may hear of ravenous dogs and wolves and cruel man-eaters, it is not easy to find states that are well and wisely governed, are curiously at variance with the notions of his age and indeed with his own life. There are many points in which he shows a modern feeling and a prophetic insight like Plato. He is a sanitary reformer. He maintains that civilized states have a right to the soil of waste countries. He is inclined to the opinion which places happiness in virtuous pleasures, but herein, as he thinks, not disagreeing from those other philosophers who define virtue to be a life according to nature. He extends the idea of happiness so as to include the happiness of others, and he argues ingeniously, all men agree that we ought to make others happy, but if others, how much more ourselves? And still he thinks that there may be a more excellent way, but to this no man's reason can attain unless heaven should inspire him with a higher truth. His ceremonies before marriage, his humane proposal that war should be carried on by assassinating the leaders of the enemy, may be compared to some of the paradoxes of Plato. He has a charming fancy, like the affinities of Greeks and barbarians in the Timaeus, that the utopians learnt the language of the Greeks with the more readiness because they were originally of the same race with them. He is penetrated with the spirit of Plato, and quotes or adapts many thoughts both from the Republic and from the Timaeus. He prefers public duties to private, and is somewhat impatient of the importunity of relations. His citizens have no silver or gold of their own, but are ready enough to pay them to their mercenaries. There is nothing of which he is more contemptuous than the love of money. Gold is used for fetters of criminals, and diamonds and pearls for children's necklaces. When the ambassadors came arrayed in gold and peacock's feathers, to the eyes of all the utopians except very few, which had been in other countries for some reasonable cause, all that gorgeousness of apparel seemed shameful and reproachful, insomuch that they most reverently saluted the vilest and most abject of them for lords, passing over the ambassadors themselves without any honor, judging them by the wearing of golden chains to be bondmen. You should have seen children also that had cast away their pearls and precious stones, when they saw the like sticking upon the ambassadors' caps, dig and push their mothers under the sides, saying thus to them, "Look, though he were a little child still." But the mother, yea, and that also in good earnest, "Peace, son," saith she, "I think he be some of the ambassador's fools." Like Plato, he is full of satirical reflections on governments and princes, on the state of the world and of knowledge. The hero of his discourse, Hyflode, is very unwilling to become a minister of state, considering that he would lose his independence and his advice would never be heeded. Compare an exquisite passage, of which the conclusion is as follows: "And verily it is naturally given, suppressed, and ended." He ridicules the new logic of his time. The utopians could never be made to understand the doctrine of second intentions, for they have not devised one of all those rules of restrictions, amplifications, and suppositions, very wittily invented in the small logicals, which here our children in every place do learn. Furthermore, they were never yet able to find out the second intentions, insomuch that none of them all could ever see man himself in common, as they call him, though he be, as you know, bigger than was ever any giant, yea, and pointed to of us even with our finger. He is very severe on the sports of the gentry. The Utopians count hunting the lowest, the vilest, and the most abject part of butchery. He quotes the words of the Republic in which the philosopher is described, standing out of the way under a wall until the driving storm of sleet and rain be overpassed, which admit of a singular application to Moore's own fate. Although writing 20 years before, about the year 1514, he can hardly be supposed to have foreseen this. There is no touch of satire which strikes deeper than his quiet remark that the greater part of the precepts of Christ are more at variance with the lives of ordinary Christians than the discourse of Utopia. And yet the most part of them is more dissident from the manners of the world nowadays than my communication was. But preachers, sly and wily men, following your counsel, as I suppose, because they saw men evil-willing to frame their manners to Christ's rule, they have wrested and ried his doctrine, and, like a rule of lead, have applied it to men's manners, that by some means, at the least way, they might agree together. The New Atlantis is only a fragment and far inferior in merit to the Utopia. The work is full of ingenuity, but wanting in creative fancy, and by no means impresses the reader with a sense of credibility. In some places, Lord Bacon is characteristically different from Sir Thomas More, as, for example, in the external state which he attributes to the governor of Solomon's house, whose dress he minutely describes, while to Sir Thomas More such trappings appear simple, ridiculous. Yet, after this program of dress, Bacon adds the beautiful trait that he had a look as though he pitied men. Several things are borrowed by him from the Timaeus, but he has injured the unity of style by adding thoughts and passages which are taken from the Hebrew scriptures. The City of the Sun, written by Campanella, 1568-1639, a Dominican friar, several years after the New Atlantis of Bacon, has many resemblances to the Republic of Plato. The citizens have wives and children in common. Their marriages are of the same temporary sort and are arranged by the magistrates from time to time. They do not, however, adopt his system of lots, but bring together the best natures, male and female, according to philosophical rules. The infants until 2 years of age are brought up by their mothers in public temples, and since individuals for the most part educate their children badly, at the beginning of their 3rd year they are committed to the care of the state, and are taught at first not out of books, but from paintings of all kinds, which are emblazoned on the walls of the city. The city has 6 interior circuits of walls, and an outer wall, which is the 7th. On this outer wall are painted the figures of legislators and philosophers, and on each of the interior walls, the symbols or forms of some one of the sciences are delineated. The women are for the most part trained like the men in warlike and other exercises, but they have 2 special occupations of their own. After a battle, they and the boys soothe and relieve the wounded warriors. Also, they encourage them with embraces and pleasant words. Some elements of the Christian or Catholic religion are preserved among them. The life of the apostles is greatly admired by this people because they had all things in common, and the short prayer which Jesus Christ taught men is used in their worship. It is a duty of the chief magistrates to pardon sins, and therefore the whole people make secret confession of them to the magistrates, and they to their chief, who is a sort of rector metaphysicus. And by this means he is well informed of all that is going on in the minds of men. After confession, absolution is granted to the citizens collectively, but no one is mentioned by name. There also exists among them a practice of perpetual prayer, performed by a succession of priests who change every hour. Their religion is a worship of God in Trinity, that is, of wisdom, love, and power, but without any distinction of persons. They behold in the sun the reflection of his glory. Mere graven images they reject, refusing to fall under the tyranny of idolatry. Many details are given about their customs of eating and drinking, about their mode of dressing, their employments, their wars. Campanella looks forward to a new mode of education, which is to be a study of nature, and not of Aristotle. He would not have his citizens waste their time in the consideration of what he calls the dead signs of things. He remarks that he who knows one science only does not really know that one any more than the rest, and insists strongly on the necessity of a variety of knowledge. More scholars are turned out in the City of the Sun in 1 year than by contemporary methods in 10 or 15. He evidently believes, like Bacon, that henceforward natural science will play a great part in education, a hope which seems hardly to have been realized, either in our own or in any former age. At any rate, the fulfillment of it has been long deferred. There is a good deal of ingenuity, and even originality in this work, and a most enlightened spirit pervades it. But it has little or no charm of style, and falls very far short of the New Atlantis of Bacon, and still more of the Utopia of Sir Thomas More. It is full of inconsistencies, and, though borrowed from Plato, shows but a superficial acquaintance with his writings. It is a work such as one might expect to have been written by a philosopher and man of genius who was also a friar, and who had spent 27 years of his life in a prison of the Inquisition. The most interesting feature of the book, common to Plato and Sir Thomas More, is the deep feeling which is shown by the writer of the misery and ignorance prevailing among the lower classes in his own time. Campanella takes note of Aristotle's answer to Plato's Community of Property, that in a society where all things are common, no individual would have any motive to work. Aristotle, Politics. He replies that his citizens being happy and contented in themselves, they are required to work only 4 hours a day, will have greater regard for their fellows than exists among men at present. He thinks, like Plato, that if he abolishes private feelings and interests, a great public feeling will take their place. Other writers on ideal states, such as the Oceana of Harrington, in which the Lord Archon, meaning Cromwell, is described, not as he was, but as he ought to have been, or the Argonus of Berkeley, which is an historical allegory of his own time, are too unlike Plato to be worth mentioning. More interesting than either of these, and far more Platonic in style and thought, is Sir John Eliot's Monarchy of Man, in which the prisoner of the Tower, no longer able to be a politician in the land of his birth, turns away from politics to view that other city which is within him, and finds on the very threshold of the grave that the secret of human happiness is the mastery of self. The change of government in the time of the English Commonwealth set men thinking about first principles, and gave rise to many works of this class. The great original genius of Swift owes nothing to Plato, nor is there any trace in the conversation or in the works of Dr. Johnson of any acquaintance with his writings. He probably would have refuted Plato without reading him, in the same fashion in which he supposed himself to have refuted Bishop Berkeley's theory of the non-existence of matter. If we accept the so-called English Platonists, or rather Neoplatonists, who never understood their master, and the writings of Coleridge, who was to some extent a kindred spirit, Plato has left no permanent impression on English literature. 7. Human life and conduct are affected by ideals in the same way that they are affected by the examples of eminent men. Neither the one nor the other are immediately applicable to practice, but there is a virtue flowing from them which tends to raise individuals above the common routine of society or trade, and to elevate states above the mere interests of commerce or the necessities of self-defense. Like the ideals of art, they are partly framed by the omission of particulars. They require to be viewed at a certain distance, and are apt to fade away if we attempt to approach them. They gain an imaginary distinctness when embodied in a state or in a system of philosophy, but they still remained the visions of a world unrealized. More striking and obvious to the ordinary mind are the examples of great men who have served their own generation and are remembered in another. Even in our own family circle there may have been someone, a woman or even a child, in whose face has shone forth a goodness more than human. The ideal then approaches nearer to us, and we fondly cling to it. The ideal of the past, whether of our own past lives or of former states of society, has a singular fascination for the minds of many. Too late we learn that such ideals cannot be recalled, though the recollection of them may have a humanizing influence on other times. But the abstractions of philosophy are, to most persons, cold and vacant. They give light without warmth. They are like the full moon in the heavens when there are no stars appearing. Men cannot live by thought alone. The world of sense is always breaking in upon them. They are for the most part confined to a corner of earth, and see but a little way beyond their own home or place of abode. They do not lift up their eyes to the hills. They are not awake when the dawn appears. But in Plato, we have reached a height from which a man may look into the distance and behold the future of the world and of philosophy. The ideal of the state and of the life of the philosopher, the ideal of an education continuing through life and extending equally to both sexes, the ideal of the unity and correlation of knowledge, the faith in good and immortality, are the vacant forms of light on which Plato is seeking to fix the eye of mankind. 8. Two other ideals, which never appeared above the horizon in Greek philosophy, float before the minds of men in our own day. One seen more clearly than formerly, as though each year and each generation brought us nearer to some great change, the other almost in the same degree retiring from view behind the laws of nature, as if oppressed by them, but still remaining a silent hope of we know not what, hidden in the heart of man. The first ideal is the future of the human race in this world. The second, the future of the individual in another. The first is the more perfect realization of our own present life. The second, the abnegation of it. The one limited by experience, the other transcending it. Both of them have been and are powerful motives of action. There are a few in whom they have taken the place of all earthly interests. The hope of a future for the human race at first sight seems to be the more disinterested, the hope of individual existence the more egotistical of the two motives. But when men have learned to resolve their hope of a future, either for themselves or for the world, into the will of God, not my will but thine, the difference between them falls away, and they may be allowed to make either of them the basis of their lives, according to their own individual character or temperament. There is as much faith in the willingness to work for an unseen future in this world as in another. Neither is it inconceivable that some rare nature may feel his duty to another generation, or to another century, almost as strongly as to his own, or that living always in the presence of God, he may realize another world as vividly as he does this. The greatest of all ideals may, or rather must be conceived by us under similitudes derived from human qualities. Although sometimes, like the Jewish prophets, we may dash away these figures of speech and describe the nature of God only in negatives. These again by degrees acquire a positive meaning. It would be well if when meditating on the higher truths, either of philosophy or religion, we sometimes substituted one form of expression for another, lest through the necessities of language we should become the slaves of mere words. There is a third ideal, not the same but akin to these, which has a place in the home and heart of every believer in the religion of Christ, and in which men seem to find a nearer and more familiar truth. The divine man, the Son of Man, the Savior of mankind, who is the firstborn and head of the whole family in heaven and earth, in whom the divine and human, that which is without and that which is within the range of our earthly faculties, are indissolubly united. Neither is this divine form of goodness wholly separable from the ideal of the Christian Church, which is said in the New Testament to be his body, or at variance with those other images of good which Plato sets before us. We see him in a figure only, and of figures of speech we select but a few, and those the simplest, to be the expression of him. We behold him in a picture, but he is not there. We gather up the fragments of his discourses, but neither do they represent him as he truly was. His dwelling is neither in heaven nor earth, but in the heart of man. This is that image which Plato saw dimly in the distance, which, when existing among men, he called, in the language of Homer, the likeness of God, the likeness of a nature which in all ages men have felt to be greater and better than themselves, and which in endless forms, whether derived from scripture or nature, from the witness of history or from the human heart, regarded as a person or not as a person, with or without parts or passions, existing in space or not in space, is and will always continue to be to mankind the idea of good. The Republic. Persons of the Dialogue. Socrates, who is the narrator. Glaucon, Adamantus, Polemarchus, Cephalus, Thrasymachus, Cleitophon, and others who are mute auditors. The scene is laid in the house of Cephalus at the Piraeus, and the whole dialogue is narrated by Socrates the day after it actually took place to Timaeus, Hermocrates, Critias, and a nameless person who are introduced in the Timaeus. Book 1. I went down yesterday to the Piraeus with Glaucon, the son of Ariston, that I might offer up my prayers to the goddess, Bendis, the Thracian Artemis, and also because I wanted to see in what manner they would celebrate the festival, which was a new thing. I was delighted with the procession of the inhabitants, but that of the Thracians was equally, if not more, beautiful. When we had finished our prayers and viewed the spectacle, we turned in the direction of the city, and at that instant Polemarchus, the son of Cephalus, chanced to catch sight of us from a distance as we were starting on our way home, and told his servant to run and bid us wait for him. The servant took hold of me by the cloak behind and said, "Polemarchus desires you to wait." I turned round and asked him where his master was. "There he is," said the youth, "coming after you, if you will only wait." "Certainly we will," said Glaucon. And in a few minutes Polemarchus appeared, and with him Adamantus, Glaucon's brother, Nicaratus, the son of Nicias, and several others who had been at the procession. Polemarchus said to me, "I perceive, Socrates, that you and your companion are already on your way to the city." "You are not far wrong," I said. "But do you see," he rejoined, "how many we are?" "Of course." "And are you stronger than all these? For if not, you will have to remain where you are." "May there not be the alternative," I said, "that we may persuade you to let us go?" "But can you persuade us if we refuse to listen to you?" he said. "Certainly not," replied Glaucon. "Then we are not going to listen, of that you may be assured." Adamantus added, "Has no one told you of the torch race on horseback in honor of the goddess which will take place in the evening?" "With horses," I replied. "That is a novelty. Will horsemen carry torches and pass them one to another during the race?" "Yes," said Polemarchus, "and not only so, but a festival will be celebrated at night which you certainly ought to see. Let us rise soon after supper and see this festival. There will be a gathering of young men, and we will have a good talk. Stay, then, and do not be perverse." Glaucon said, "I suppose, since you insist, that we must." "Very good," I replied. Accordingly, we went with Polemarchus to his house, and there we found his brothers Lysias and Euthydemus, and with them Thrasymachus the Chalcedonian, Carmentides the Paeonian, and Cleitophon the son of Aristonomus. There too was Cephalus, the father of Polemarchus, whom I had not seen for a long time, and I thought him very much aged. He was seated on a cushioned chair and had a garland on his head, for he had been sacrificing in the court. And there were some other chairs in the room arranged in a semicircle, upon which we sat down by him. He saluted me eagerly, and then he said, "You don't come to see me, Socrates, as often as you ought. If I were still able to go and see you, I would not ask you to come to me. But at my age I can hardly get to the city, and therefore you should come oftener to the Piraeus. For let me tell you that the more the pleasures of the body fade away, the greater to me is the pleasure and charm of conversation. Do not then deny my request, but make our house your resort, and keep company with these young men. We are old friends, and you will be quite at home with us." I replied, "There is nothing which for my part I like better, Cephalus, than conversing with aged men, for I regard them as travelers who have gone a journey which I too may have to go, and of whom I ought to inquire whether the way is smooth and easy or rugged and difficult. And this is a question which I should like to ask of you who have arrived at that time which the poets call the threshold of old age. Is life harder towards the end, or what report do you give of it? I will tell you, Socrates, he said, what my own feeling is. Men of my age flock together. We are birds of a feather, as the old proverb says, and at our meetings the tale of my acquaintance commonly is, I cannot eat, I cannot drink. The pleasures of youth and love are fled away. There was a good time once, but now that is gone, and life is no longer life. Some complain of the slights which are put upon them by relations, and they will tell you sadly of how many evils their old age is the cause. But to me, Socrates, these complainers seem to blame that which is not really in fault. For if old age were the cause, I too being old, and every other old man, would have felt as they do. But this is not my own experience, nor that of others whom I have known. How well I remember the aged poet Sophocles, when in answer to the question, "How does love suit with age, Sophocles? Are you still the man you were?" "Peace," he replied. "Most gladly have I escaped the thing of which you speak. I feel as if I had escaped from a mad and furious master." His words have often occurred to my mind since, and they seem as good to me now as at the time when he uttered them. For certainly old age has a great sense of calm and freedom. When the passions relax their hold, then, as Sophocles says, we are freed from the grasp not of one mad master only, but of many. The truth is, Socrates, that these regrets, and also the complaints about relations, are to be attributed to the same cause, which is not old age, but men's characters and tempers. For he who is of a calm and happy nature will hardly feel the pressure of age, but to him is of an opposite disposition, youth and age are equally a burden. I listened in admiration, and wanting to draw him out that he might go on, "Yes, Cephalus," I said, "but I'd rather suspect that people in general are not convinced by you when you speak thus. They think that old age sits lightly upon you, not because of your happy disposition, but because you are rich, and wealth is well known to be a great comforter." "You are right," he replied. "They are not convinced. And there is something in what they say, not, however, so much as they imagine. I might answer them as Themistocles answered the Seriphian who was abusing him and saying that he was famous not for his own merits but because he was an Athenian. If you had been a native of my country or I of yours, neither of us would have been famous. And to those who are not rich and are impatient of old age, the same reply may be made. For to the good poor man, old age cannot be a light burden, nor can a bad rich man ever have peace with himself." "May I ask, Cephalus, whether your fortune was for the most part inherited or acquired by you?"
"Acquired? Socrates, do you want to know how much I acquired? In the art of making money, I have been midway between my father and grandfather. For my grandfather, whose name I bear, doubled and trebled the value of his patrimony, that which he inherited being much what I possess now. But my father, Lysanias, reduced the property below what it is at present, and I shall be satisfied if I leave to these my sons not less but a little more than I received." "That was why I asked you the question," I replied, "because I see that you are indifferent about money, which is a characteristic rather of those who have inherited their fortunes than of those who have acquired them. The makers of fortunes have a second love of money as a creation of their own, resembling the affection of authors for their own poems or of parents for their children, besides that natural love of it for the sake of use and profit which is common to them and all men. And hence they are very bad company, for they can talk about nothing but the praises of wealth."
"That is true," he said. "Yes, that is very true. But may I ask another question? What do you consider to be the greatest blessing which you have reaped from your wealth?"
"One," he said, "of which I could not expect easily to convince others. For let me tell you, Socrates, that when a man thinks himself to be near death, fears and cares enter into his mind which he never had before. The tales of a world below, and the punishment which is exacted there of deeds done here, were once a laughing matter to him.
But now he is tormented with the thought that they may be true, either from the weakness of age, or because he is now drawing nearer to that other place, he has a clearer view of these things. Suspicions and alarms crowd thickly upon him, and he begins to reflect and consider what wrongs he has done to others. And when he finds that the sum of his transgressions is great, he will many a time like a child start up in his sleep for fear, and he is filled with dark forebodings. But to him who is conscious of no sin, sweet hope, as Pindar charmingly says, is the kind nurse of his age. Hope, he says, cherishes the soul of him who lives in justice and holiness, and is the nurse of his age and the companion of his journey. Hope, which is mightiest to sway the restless soul of man. How admirable are his words! And the great blessing of riches I do not say to every man, but to a good man, is that he has had no occasion to deceive or to defraud others, either intentionally or unintentionally. And when he departs to the world below, he is not in any apprehension about offerings due to the gods or debts which he owes to men. Now to this peace of mind, the possession of wealth greatly contributes, and therefore I say that, setting one thing against another, of the many advantages which wealth has to give, to a man of sense, this is, in my opinion, the greatest.
Well said, Cephalus, I replied. But as concerning justice, what is it? To speak the truth and to pay your debts? No more than this? And even to this, are there not exceptions? Suppose that a friend, when in his right mind, has deposited arms with me, and he asks for them when he is not in his right mind, ought I to give them back to him? No one would say that I ought, or that I should be right in doing so, any more than they would say that I ought always to speak the truth to one who is in his condition.
You are quite right, he replied. But then, I said, speaking the truth and paying your debts is not a correct definition of justice.
Quite correct, Socrates, if Simonides is to be believed, said Polemarchus, interposing.
I fear, said Cephalus, that I must go now, for I have to look after the sacrifices, and I hand over the argument to Polemarchus and the company.
Is not Polemarchus your heir? I said.
To be sure, he answered,
and went away laughing to the sacrifices. Tell me then, O thou heir of the argument, what did Simonides say, and according to you truly say, about justice?
He said that the repayment of a debt is just, and in saying so he appears to me to be right.
I should be sorry to doubt the word of such a wise and inspired man, but his meaning, though probably clear to you, is the reverse of clear to me. For he certainly does not mean, as we were just now saying, that I ought to return a deposit of arms or of anything else to one who asks for it when he is not in his right senses. And yet a deposit cannot be denied to be a debt.
True.
Then when the person who asks me is not in his right mind, I am by no means to make the return?
Certainly not.
When Simonides said that the repayment of a debt was justice, he did not mean to include that case?
Certainly not, for he thinks that a friend ought always to do good to a friend and never evil.
You mean that the return of a deposit of gold, which is to the injury of the receiver, if the two parties are friends, is not the repayment of a debt? That is what you would imagine him to say?
Yes.
And are enemies also to receive what we owe to them?
To be sure, he said. They are to receive what we owe them, and an enemy, as I take it, owes to an enemy that which is due or proper to him, that is to say, evil.
Simonides, then, after the manner of poets, would seem to have spoken darkly of the nature of justice, for he really meant to say that justice is the giving to each man what is proper to him, and this he termed a debt.
That must have been his meaning, he said.
By heaven, I replied, and if we asked him what due or proper thing is given by medicine and to whom, what answer do you think that he would make to us?
He would surely reply that medicine gives drugs and meat and drink to human bodies. And what due or proper thing is given by cookery, and to what? Seasoning to food? And what is that which justice gives, and to whom? If, Socrates, we are to be guided at all by the analogy of the preceding instances, then justice is the art which gives good to friends and evil to enemies. That is his meaning, then? I think so. And who is best able to do good to his friends and evil to his enemies in time of sickness? The physician. Or when they are on a voyage amid the perils of the sea? The pilot? And in what sort of actions, or with a view to what result, is the just man most able to do harm to his enemy and good to his friend? In going to war against the one and in making alliances with the other. But when a man is well, my dear Polemarchus, there is no need of a physician? No. And he who is not on a voyage has no need of a pilot? No. Then in time of peace, justice will be of no use? I am very far from thinking so. You think that justice may be of use in peace as well as in war? Yes. Like husbandry for the acquisition of corn? Yes. Or like shoemaking for the acquisition of shoes? That is what you mean? Yes. And what similar use or power of acquisition has justice in time of peace? In contract, Socrates, justice is of use. And by contracts you mean partnerships. Exactly. But is the just man, or the skillful player, a more useful and better partner at a game of draughts? The skillful player. And in the laying of bricks and stones, is the just man a more useful or better partner than the builder? Quite the reverse. Then, in what sort of partnership is the just man a better partner than the harp player? As in, playing the harp player is certainly a better partner than the just man. In a money partnership? Yes, Polemarchus, but surely not in the use of money. For you do not want a just man to be your counselor in the purchase or sale of a horse. A man who is knowing about horses would be better for that, would he not? Certainly. And when you want to buy a ship, the shipwright or the pilot would be better. True. Then what is that joint use of silver or gold in which the just man is to be preferred? When you want a deposit to be kept safely. You mean when money is not wanted but allowed to lie? Precisely. That is to say, justice is useful when money is useless? That is the inference. And when you want to keep a pruning hook safe, then justice is useful to the individual and to the state. But when you want to use it, then the art of the vine dresser? Clearly. And when you want to keep a shield or a lyre and not to use them, you would say that justice is useful. But when you want to use them, then the art of the soldier or of the musician? Certainly. And so of all other things. Justice is useful when they are useless, and useless when they are useful? That is the inference. Then justice is not good for much. But let us consider this further point. Is not he who can best strike a blow in a boxing match or in any kind of fighting best able to ward off a blow? Certainly. And he who is most skillful in preventing or escaping from a disease is best able to create one. True. And he is the best guard of the camp who is best able to steal a march upon the enemy? Certainly. Then he who is a good keeper of anything is also a good thief? That, I suppose, is to be inferred. Then if the just man is good at keeping money, he is good at stealing it. That is implied in the argument. Then, after all, the just man has turned out to be a thief, and this is a lesson which I suspect you must have learnt out of Homer, for he, speaking of Autolycus, the maternal grandfather of Odysseus, who is a favorite of his, affirms that he was excellent above all men in theft and perjury. And so you and Homer and Simonides are agreed that justice is an art of theft. To be practiced, however, for the good of friends and for the harm of enemies. That was what you were saying? No, certainly not that, though I do not now know what I did say. But I will stand by the latter words. Well, there is another question. By friends and enemies, do we mean those who are so really, or only in seeming. Surely, he said, a man may be expected to love those whom he thinks good, and to hate those whom he thinks evil. Yes, but do not persons often err about good and evil? Many who are not good seem to be so, and conversely? That is true. Then to them the good will be enemies, and the evil will be their friends. True. And in that case they will be right in doing good to the evil and evil to the good? Clearly. But the good are just, and would not do an injustice. True. Then according to your argument, it is just to injure those who do no wrong. Nay, Socrates, the doctrine is immoral. Then I suppose that we ought to do good to the just and harm to the unjust? I like that better. But see the consequence. Many a man who is ignorant of human nature has friends who are bad friends, and in that case he ought to do harm to them, and he has good enemies whom he ought to benefit. But if so, we shall be saying the very opposite of that which we affirm to be the meaning of Simonides. Very true, he said, and I think that we had better correct an error into which we seem to have fallen in the use of the words friend and enemy. What was the error, Polemarchus? I asked. We assume that he is a friend who seems to be or who is thought good. And how is the error to be corrected? We should rather say that he is a friend who is, as well as seems, good, and that he who seems only and is not good only seems to be and is not a friend, and of an enemy the same may be said. You would argue that the good are our friends and the bad are enemies? Yes. And instead of saying simply, as we did at first, that it is just to do good to our friends and harm to our enemies, we should further say, it is just to do good to our friends when they are good and harm to our enemies when they are evil. Yes, that appears to me to be the truth. But ought the just to injure anyone at all? Undoubtedly he ought to injure those who are both wicked and his enemies. When horses are injured, are they improved or deteriorated? The latter. Deteriorated, that is to say, in the good qualities of horses, not of dogs. Yes, of horses. And dogs are deteriorated in the good qualities of dogs, and not of horses? Of course. And will not men who are injured be deteriorated in that which is the proper virtue of man? Certainly. And that human virtue is justice? To be sure. Then men who are injured are of necessity made unjust. That is the result. But can the musician, by his art, make men unmusical? Certainly not. Or the horseman, by his art, make them bad horsemen? Impossible. And can the just, by justice, make men unjust? Or, speaking generally, can the good, by virtue, make them bad? Assuredly not. Any more than heat can produce cold? It cannot. Or drought moisture? Clearly not. Nor can the good harm anyone? Impossible. And the just is the good? Certainly. Then to injure a friend or anyone else is not the act of a just man, but of the opposite, who is the unjust? I think that what you say is quite true, Socrates. Then if a man says that justice consists in the repayment of debts, and that good is the debt which a just man owes to his friends, and evil the debt which he owes to his enemies, to say this is not wise, for it is not true if, as has been clearly shown, the injuring of another can be in no case just. I agree with you, said Polemarchus. Then you and I are prepared to take up arms against anyone who attributes such a saying to Simonides or Bias or Pittacus or any other wise man or seer? I am quite ready to do battle at your side, he said. Shall I tell you whose I believe the saying to be? Whose? I believe that Periander, or Perdiccas, or Xerxes, or Ismenius the Theban, or some other rich and mighty man, who had a great opinion of his own power, was the first to say that justice is doing good to your friends and harm to your enemies. Most true, he said. Yes, I said. But if this definition of justice also breaks down, What other can be offered? Several times in the course of the discussion, Thrasymachus had made an attempt to get the argument into his own hands, and had been put down by the rest of the company who wanted to hear the end. But when Polemarchus and I had done speaking and there was a pause, he could no longer hold his peace, and gathering himself up he came at us like a wild beast, seeking to devour us. We were quite panic-stricken at the sight of him. He roared out to the whole company, "What folly, Socrates, has taken possession of you all? And why, silly billies, do you knock under to one another? I say that if you want really to know what justice is, you should not only ask, but answer, and you should not seek honor to yourself from the refutation of an opponent, but have your own answer. For there is many a one who can ask and cannot answer. And now I will not have you say that justice is duty or advantage or profit or gain or interest, for this sort of nonsense will not do for me. I must have clearness and accuracy." I was panic-stricken at his words, and could not look at him without trembling. Indeed, I believe that if I had not fixed my eye upon him, I should have been struck dumb. But when I saw his fury rising, I looked at him first, and was therefore able to reply to him. "Thrasymachus," I said with a quiver, "don't be hard upon us. Polemarchus and I may have been guilty of a little mistake in the argument, but I can assure you that the error was not intentional. If we were seeking for a piece of gold, you would not imagine that we were knocking under to one another, and so losing our chance of finding it. And why, when we are seeking for justice, a thing more precious than many pieces of gold, do you say that we are weakly yielding to one another and not doing our utmost to get at the truth? Nay, my good friend, we are most willing and anxious to do so. But the fact is that we cannot. And if so, you people who know all things should pity us and not be angry with us." "How characteristic of Socrates," he replied with a bitter laugh. "That's your ironical style. Did I not foresee, have I not already told you that whatever he was asked, he would refuse to answer and try irony or any other shuffle in order that he might avoid answering?" "You are a philosopher, Thrasymachus," I replied, "and well know that if you ask a person what numbers make up 12, taking care to prohibit him whom you ask from answering twice 6, or 3 times 4, or 6 times 2, or 4 times 3, for this sort of nonsense will not do for me, then obviously, if that is your way of putting the question, no one can answer you. But suppose that he were to retort, 'Thrasymachus, what do you mean? If one of these numbers which you interdict be the true answer to the question, am I falsely to say some other number which is not the right one? Is that your meaning?' How would you answer him?"
"Just as if the two cases were at all alike," he said.
"Why should they not be?" I replied. "And even if they are not, but only appear to be so to the person who is asked, ought he not to say what he thinks, whether you or I forbid him or not?"
"I presume then that you are going to make one of the interdicted answers?"
"I dare say that I may, notwithstanding the danger, if upon reflection I approve of any of them."
"But what if I give you an answer about justice other and better," he said, "than any of these? What do you deserve to have done to you?"
"Done to me? As becomes the ignorant, I must learn from the wise. That is what I deserve to have done to me."
"What, and no payment? A pleasant notion."
"I will pay when I have the money," I replied.
"But you have, Socrates," said Glaucon. "And you, Thrasymachus, need be under no anxiety about money, for we will all make a contribution for Socrates."
"Yes," he replied, "and then Socrates will do as he always does, refuse to answer himself, but take and pull to pieces the answer of someone else."
"Why, my good friend," I said, "how can anyone answer who knows and says that he knows just nothing, and who, even if he has some faint notions of his own, is told by a man of authority not to utter them? The natural thing is that the speaker should be someone like yourself who professes to know and can tell what he knows. Will you then kindly answer, for the edification of the company and of myself. Glaucon and the rest of the company joined in my request, and Thrasymachus, as anyone might see, was in reality eager to speak, for he thought that he had an excellent answer and would distinguish himself. But at first he affected to insist on my answering. At length he consented to begin. "Behold," he said, "the wisdom of Socrates. He refuses to teach himself and goes about learning of others, to whom he never even says thank you." "That I learn of others," I replied, "is quite true. But that I am ungrateful, I wholly deny. Money I have none, and therefore I pay in praise, which is all I have. And how ready I am to praise anyone who appears to me to speak well, you will very soon find out when you answer, for I expect that you will answer well." "Listen, then," he said. "I proclaim that justice is nothing else than the interest of the stronger. And now why do you not praise me? But of course you won't." "Let me first understand you," I replied. "Justice, as you say, is the interest of the stronger. What, Thrasymachus, is the meaning of this? You cannot mean to say that because Polydamas, the Pancratiast, is stronger than we are, and finds the eating of beef conducive to his bodily strength, that to eat beef is therefore equally for our good, who are weaker than he is, and right and just for us? That's abominable of you, Socrates. You take the words in the sense which is most damaging to the argument." "Not at all, my good sir," I said. "I'm trying to understand them, and I wish that you would be a little clearer." "Well," he said, "have you never heard that forms of government differ? There are tyrannies, and there are democracies, and there are aristocracies." "Yes, I know." "And the government is the ruling power in each state?" "Certainly." "And the different forms of government make laws democratical, aristocratical, tyrannical, with a view to their own several interests? And these laws, which are made by them for their own interests, are the justice which they deliver to their subjects? And him who transgresses them, they punish as a breaker of the law and unjust. And that is what I mean when I say that in all states there is the same principle of justice, which is the interest of the government. And as the government must be supposed to have power, the only reasonable conclusion is that everywhere there is one principle of justice, which is the interest of the stronger." "Now I understand you," I said. "And whether you are right or not, I will try to discover. But let me remark that in defining justice, you have yourself used the word interest, which you forbade me to use. It is true, however, that in your definition the words of the stronger are added." "A small addition, you must allow," he said. "Great or small, never mind about that. We must first inquire whether what you are saying is the truth. Now, we are both agreed that justice is interest of some sort, but you go on to say, of the stronger. About this addition I am not so sure, and must therefore consider further."
"Proceed."
"I will. And first tell me, do you admit that it is just for subjects to obey their rulers?"
"I do."
"But are the rulers of states absolutely infallible, or are they sometimes liable to err?"
"To be sure," he replied, "they are liable to err."
"Then in making their laws, they may sometimes make them rightly and sometimes not?"
"True."
"When they make them rightly, they make them agreeably to their interest. When they are mistaken, contrary to their interest. You admit that?"
"Yes."
"And the laws which they make must be obeyed by their subjects."
"And that is what you call justice?"
"Doubtless." "Then justice, according to your argument, is not only obedience to the interest of the stronger, but the reverse."
"What is that you are saying?" he asked.
"I am only repeating what you are saying, I believe. But let us consider, have we not admitted that the rulers may be mistaken about their own interest in what they command, and also that to obey them is justice? Has not that been admitted?"
"Yes."
"Then you must also have acknowledged justice not to be for the interest of the stronger, when the rulers unintentionally command things to be done which are to their own injury. For if, as you say, justice is the obedience